stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting a victory for Iraqi forces in the fight against the Islamic State. Iraqi military officials say they have now retaken control of a government complex in Ramadi. Islamic State fighters having fled the last major IS stronghold in the western city that fell to militants 7 months ago. It is believed recapturing this complex will restore control of the key city, which is the capital of Anbar province. The whole neighborhood surrounding the complex was dotted with landmines. Iraqi military spokesman said soldiers used airstrikes to detonate some of the explosives to help them gain ground. It's not clear how many civilians are left in the area. The spokesman said most of the residents took shelter in a nearby hospital. This is the most significant incursion into Ramadi by Iraqi forces since the city fell to IS terrorists in May. In Syria, a victory there as well. In part, Syrian government forces booby-trapped a cluster of farm buildings in the southern Dara province and detonated the explosives as several Islamic rebel factions gathered at the venue, killing 17 militants, opposition activists said today. A UN-brokered plan to evacuate thousands of jihadist fighters under siege near Syria's capital has now been delayed after Friday's killing of an anti-government rebel leader who was to guarantee safe passage to the militants. As many as 4,000 Islamic State fighters and their families based in southern Damascus were set to evacuate early Saturday, but the Britain-based monitoring group Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said that deal stalled hours after rebel leader Zanran Alush was killed in an airstrike near Damascus. Monitors say that the military forces, some sources say, it was President Bashar al-Assad's forces that killed Alush. Other sources say it was Russian airstrikes that proved deadly. This is VOA News. Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for an attack in northeast Kenya that killed at least two police officers today. A statement on a pro-Al-Shabaab website said fighters from the group ambushed a Kenyan military convoy as it left the town of Al-Waq on the Kenyan-Somalia border bound for Mandera. The Kenyan Red Cross said two police officers were killed and two others injured in the attack. Al-Shabaab said three police officers were killed. Israeli forces shot dead two Palestinians ages 17 and 23 after they stabbed and wounded an Israeli soldier in the occupied West Bank. And earlier today, a Palestinian stabbed a soldier near Jerusalem's main bus station. On Saturday, Palestinian protesters gathered in Jerusalem's Old City demanding that Israel hand over the remains of Palestinians killed in attacks or during clashes with Israeli troops. A wave of violence since the start of October has killed nearly 130 Palestinians and 20 Israelis. Afghan officials say a militia controlled by a prominent lawmaker has beheaded four Islamic State militants in the eastern province of Nangarhar. The militia members, loyal to Zahir Qadr, Deputy Speaker of Parliament, have been fighting with IS-affiliated gunmen in the region for weeks. IS fighters recently captured four militia members and beheaded them, prompting the militia to respond by killing four Islamic State fighters in Aachen District, according to local officials. Authorities in the Central African Republic once again have postponed national elections for president and parliament. They were to be held today, but are now set for December 30th. Logistical difficulties are the reason being cited for the delay. Central Africans are hoping the elections will turn a page in the three-year-long sectarian conflict between Muslims and non-Muslims that erupted after rebels ousted President Francois Bozizé in 2013. Human rights researcher Louis Mudge tells VOA the election will only be the first step in what's needed for the Central African Republic.
The elections in of themselves are not going to simply bring about an end to the conflict. It's going to have to be a more long-term process. It's going to have to incorporate issues about holding perpetrators of serious crimes accountable. There has to be real reconciliation efforts made across the sectarian divide between Muslims and non-Muslims. And there needs to be a meaningful development program set up in the country so people have a reason to be hopeful again. Good that the elections are happening. Good that the run-up has been peaceful thus far, more or less. But they're not going to be a silver bullet in of themselves. They're not going to simply solve very deep-rooted problems in the Central African Republic.
International organizations have been pushing for the CAR to hold elections before the end of 2015. I'm Marty Johnson in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Believe that this is the time for us to resume the talks from where they stopped and allow all the political stakeholders, who I believe and everybody should know will have to be peaceful stakeholders.
Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni will jumpstart peace negotiations between the government of Burundi and opposition groups on Monday.
We are here before Parliament with our proposals for salary increment. Parliament agrees with us. But somehow, money is never
good. The Ugandan Parliament considers increasing the wages of members of the Electoral Commission ahead of next year's general election.
Each one of us and all of us have done wrong in this country and have destroyed ourselves.
And a prominent South Sudanese cleric calls for peace and unity as the world's newest nation begins effort to restore stability after months of conflict. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni will jumpstart fresh peace negotiations between the government of Burundi and opposition groups in the capital Kampala on Monday. The negotiations come as the African Union reportedly assured Burundi that it has no ulterior motive in its recent proposal to send about 5,000 peacekeepers to help protect unarmed civilians who face violence. It is not clear if Monday's talks will consider the AU's Peace and Security Council's proposal to send the peacekeepers to protect civilians in the Burundi crisis. Burundi's Foreign Minister Alain Nyamitwe told me the government in Bujumbura would not go against the will of the people in their strong opposition to the African Union's proposal to send peacekeepers.
We believe that this is the time for us to resume the talks from where they stopped and allow all the political stakeholders, who I believe and everybody should know will have to be peaceful stakeholders, as has been recommended and sealed by the Security Council, which, if you remember, has come up with a resolution calling the government and all interested peaceful stakeholders to resume dialogue. That means that all those people who, in the meantime, or who before the elections, have gotten involved into sabotage activities, into coup d'etat, into violent extremism, which has manifested itself through the attacks on the government forces, all of those people should not find themselves around the table.
You're talking about security. A rebel group or a resistance group have come up. Will this be discussed?
Security is a matter of the government. That's exactly why the government forces are after those people who have taken up arms against the civilians and against the government troops. It goes without saying that every time a group props up, with weapons, they will have to face the vigilance of our troops. But we have to be very clear also that if anybody wants to reach some political goals, he cannot or they cannot go through mounting rebel forces. That is exactly the opposite of what Resolution 2248 calls for. I mean, for us, that is a no-go area.
The AU chairperson, Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, I understand, has contacted President Nkurunziza, assuring him that the decision of the Peace and Security Council to propose sending peacekeepers to Burundi is not an ulterior motive from the African Union. How are you taking this reassurance from the chairperson of the African Union?
For me, that's not even an issue for me, because the people have expressed themselves against those troops. So I don't know what needs to be said again. Which government will go against the will of the people? The people have demonstrated against those troops, and we have only forwarded to the AU the sentiment expressed by the people. Now, whether the chairperson of the commission has reassured the president, that one I don't know. I only know that there was a letter which was sent to us
after another letter which was sent to Ban Ki-moon, Secretary General of the United Nations, which again for us was just a demonstration of a fait accompli. And we do not want to dwell on this any longer, because for us there was a decision which we believe was not well thought of, and also that there was a reaction of the government, but also more specifically by the people themselves. If you have followed the events in Bujumbura, the whole country yesterday was demonstrating against those troops. So I don't know whether it is still relevant for me to talk about those troops. Maybe tomorrow, maybe another day, when the people of Burundi say they want these troops, then maybe at that time they'll be most welcome.
Pragmatically speaking, what do you see as the prospect of these peace talks?
Well, I believe that it is clear that we, with these talks on Monday, all the stakeholders have to agree and reconfirm their commitment to peace and peaceful means for them to attain political goals. It also has to be very clear also that no, you know, any other strategy aiming at reaching power through force will be accepted in the country. Once we agree on those principles, then we can start preparing for the next elections, which is 2020.
Alain Nyamitwe is the Burundian foreign minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Bujumbura. Uganda's parliament is considering a possible 100% pay increase for all electoral commission officials ahead of February's national and local elections. Officials of the electoral body have not received a single raise since 1999, and some lawmakers say the time has come. The parliamentarians argue that other public sector workers, including teachers, have received one or more pay hikes over the same period. Electoral Commission spokesman Jotham Taremwa told me earlier that members of the commission earn meager salaries and long overdue for a raise.
Since 1999, we have never had any salary increment as Electoral Commission staff. Year in, year out, we appear before Parliament with our proposals for salary increment. Parliament agrees with us, but somehow money is never got, and we keep on the same pay. In 1999, a dollar to a shilling was about 1,500. For now, a dollar to a shilling has come to around 4,000 Uganda shillings. The conditions of living have completely changed. Most constitutional bodies have had the opportunity to have their salary increments considered. So it is our prayer that even now, government should find money and increase our salaries. We earn meager salaries, okay? So that is our plea and our cry, and we hope government can listen, whether there are elections next year or not. But I think it is long overdue.
Justifying the pay rise proposal, the chairperson of the Legal and Parliamentary Affairs Committee, Mr. Stephen Tashobia, said that miserable pay could lead EC officials into temptations, adding that EC operatives on the salary structure that was set up in 1999 is not good enough. Now, how are your fellow colleagues in the Electoral Commission reacting to the seriousness that parliamentarians are attaching to the increment that your chairman is advocating?
In my personal view, I think corruption is a moral issue. It is not about how much one earns. But again, I think there was nothing wrong with him saying this is a big temptation. Have somebody who is paid less and is handling business worth millions of money. The fact of the matter is that for a long time we have not had any salary increment. And we are requesting that this time around the government considers our request. It does not have any relationship with the fact that we are going into elections. But the issue is that these people have not had their salaries increased for a very, very long time. Standards of living have changed. Things have gone up, but they are still on the same salary they last got in 1999. So I think that is what the public needs to understand. That is what our stakeholders need to understand. It is not an incentive in any way to hand elections in a way that reflects salary increment.
The government has often said to public sector workers that there is no available funds anywhere to raise to meet their demand for pay increases. What is your view?
But why should it be the request of Electoral Commission that does not have funding from anywhere? We have seen other government workers whose salaries have been increased. I don't buy that reasoning. I believe if there is commitment on the part of government, money can be found. They have found money for teachers. They have found money for other parastatals. Why not the Electoral Commission? I don't believe in that in that position, and I still think that governments can find money and increase our salaries.
How hopeful are you that the government this time around will consider this proposal to increase salaries of Electoral Commission officials?
We remain hopeful. We will engage with government. We will explain our situation as Electoral Commission staff to make sure the government understands our earnings in details, to know that really we deserve a salary increment. And I hope if government gets to understand it better, then it will look for money. I am sure it can find money somewhere and be able to support our salary request.
Jotham Taremwa is the spokesman for the Electoral Commission of Uganda. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. The Archbishop of the Juba Catholic Archdiocese is urging South Sudan's government and armed opposition leaders to adhere to the timetable set by the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission for implementing the peace deal. At the same time, Archbishop Paulino Lukudo Loru called on all South Sudanese to forgive each other. For VOA Mugumi, Davis Rakaringe has this report from the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
In his Christmas message, Archbishop Lukudu says everyone should work towards building a peaceful nation, adding that Jesus was born to bring peace into the world.
Each one of us and all of us have done wrong in this country and have destroyed ourselves. We have sinned against God and against our people. Now that we are trying to come to peace by God's power, what should we do then? Repent, ask pardon, give pardon, forgive, and decide to start a new life, to end war and bring peace.
Lukudu praised South Sudan's two warring sides, led by President Salva Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar, for agreeing to start implementation talks on the peace agreement in Juba. Archbishop Lukudu says both sides must embrace the latest timetable endorsed by the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or JMEC.
We believe that this situation now is exactly the implementation of that document. So since that document, we as church leaders, we have accepted that this is the way forward. For us, this was the way forward to reach to peace, because without it, we would not know where we were going again. We were just going to be abandoned to fighting, to killing, and as usual.
Under the new timetable, various institutions and the new transitional government will be formed by the end of January. In order to achieve that, Lukudu says, the warring parties must work out the details in good faith.
They must accept that, look, you have sinned, I have sinned. We are all wrong. And as wrong people, as sinners, let us accept now to come together and really work to bring the peace that the people of God in South Sudan are looking for, and not anymore to be thinking of war, to be thinking of differences, to be thinking of problems, difficulties, positions, and this and that.
Yesterday, South Sudan's Vice President, James Iwani Iga, assured Lukudu and other Catholic Church leaders in Juba that his government is serious about peace. Lukudu says South Sudanese have suffered for too long and must now have peace so they can go on with their lives.
We have spoiled Christmas 2013. Let Christmas 2015 bring us back to joy, to peace, to reconciliation and to celebration.
Over the years, church leaders like Archbishop Olukudu have been instrumental in reconciling different ethnic communities across South Sudan. Several local churches have founded organizations that help provide humanitarian assistance across the country. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
In 2015 has been a hungry year for much of the African continent. In East and Southern Africa, El Nino and climate fluctuations have provoked serious crisis. Conflict in South Sudan and the Central African Republic have had the same effect, as have poverty and a population boom in the Sahel. Africa is entering 2016 amid looming food shortages in several regions. From Johannesburg, South Africa, VOA's Anita Powell takes a look at what these separate crises have in common.
Hunger has hit Africa hard this year as climate change, conflict, and enduring poverty have ravaged multiple countries and left tens of millions of people in dire straits. Countries as diverse as South Sudan, Malawi, and the Central African Republic have sounded the alarm in recent months. Some, like many Southern and East African nations, are suffering from the double whammy of two droughts in a row. Others, like the Central African Republic and Sudan, are in trouble because of conflict and massive displacement. The UN's World Food Program says sub-Saharan Africa already has the world's highest prevalence of hunger. One person in four is undernourished. Every day in Africa, 23 million children go to school hungry. The agency's David Orr says that in the lower half of Africa, where weather is the main culprit, 2015 has been an unusually difficult year.
I think what makes things different this year is the combination of drought and then an El Nino weather event coming right after that, so that people are effectively being hit by two consecutive years of reduced rainfall. And it's particularly difficult on a region where 70% of the population are subsistence farmers.
But African governments say they too have an important role to play, and that the hunger crisis is their failure as well. Malawi's Minister of Finance earlier this year described his nation's hunger situation as a scandal and pledged to do more. In Ethiopia, the government has committed a record sum, $192 million, amid news that as many as 10 million people will face critical food shortages next year because of a crippling drought. John Graham, Save the Children's country director in Ethiopia, told VOA News that African governments need to do more as international donor budgets are increasingly squeezed by crises elsewhere in the world. But he says they still can't do it alone.
The Ethiopian government has stepped up. They pledged about $200 million, which is far more than I've ever seen them pledge for any other emergency. And so I think that they're really trying to do their best. But I think the international community should stand by them and also make big pledges. And so far, you know, I've been here for 18 years, and this is the slowest response that I've seen to this type of crisis.
Elsewhere on the continent, such as in South Sudan, the problems are trickier. There, 2 years of brutal conflict have played a huge role in pushing hundreds of thousands of people to starvation. But aid officials say aid agencies can only do so much on their own, or again.
We and the other humanitarian agencies are there to support the governments, and that's more and more what we are doing, not just providing lean season relief programs and other forms of food assistance, but actually giving technical support and institutional capacity to really increase the ability of governments to solve these problems for themselves.
That, everyone acknowledges, is a long and difficult process, but one that governments and donors need to tackle if they want to avoid a repeat of 2015. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
In Zimbabwe, close to 60 women were cured of ailments caused by fistula, thanks to a recent obstetric operation campaign by the group called the Health Alliance International, or WAHA. Also participating were Chinoyi Provincial Hospital, the Zimbabwe Ministry of Health, and the United Nations. Thanks to the project, scores of women around the country received free treatment for such problems as fecal and bladder incontinence. Free transportation, boarding, and surgery were provided. Marvelous Nyauye of VOA Zimbabwe Service spoke with Fortune Mabandi, National Outreach Coordinator with Women and Health Alliance International.
It went very well. We managed to operate on about 58 skilled women who had either fecal incontinence or urine incontinence, but it went very well.
What is fistula? For some people that may have just tuned in today and want to learn about what kind of operations your organization does.
A fistula is a condition whereby a hole forms within the rectum or the bladder caused by a traumatic birthing experience. By that, I mean you've taken too long before you've given birth or you've been in labor too long. That usually is the end result. You get a fistula where the tissue is now weakened and the bladder cracks open.
So what kind of assistance does your organization offer for women that may be experiencing this?
What we have been doing so far in Zimbabwe as Women and Health Alliance, we've been offering, firstly, transport to bring them to whichever center the ministry has given us to work from. In this case, we're working from Chinoy Provincial Hospital. So we would give them transport from either Kipinge, Buhera, Bikita. It doesn't matter which part of Zimbabwe they're coming from. Would fully sponsor their transport and then would pay in full their hospital bills, including the surgery and the aftercare, which means at least 3 weeks stay in hospital post-operation. Would also provide things like your basic toiletries, because most of them come from a place where they don't actually afford to part with things as simple as a bucket. So we give the basic ablutions on arrival. And we also offer rehabilitation to women who have been repaired. By rehabilitation, we mean for those that are as young as 15 years old, because we've got such patients, we allow them a chance to go back to school to finish either their ordinary level or some sort of certificate to allow them to be able to look after themselves in the future. And for the more mature women, we also allow a communication program of doing either poultry project or clothes making, as long as they're able to assist themselves afterwards. That's the kind of rehabilitation we've been offering post-operation.
For those that may want to utilize your services, where can they find you?
Currently, we are based in Harare. What we do is, as we are directed by the ministry, we just go to whichever center. But we're currently taking calls for all those who've got the condition.
So when is your next program, if there are some listening out there who'd actually like to enroll? When do you have the next clinic?
The next camp is most likely going to be in February. We want to also give the institutions we work with a chance to give their members of staff a rest, because our campaigns are so concentrated. So our next camp is most likely in February. But we can't really say, because we've got a lot of other players that are involved. We are now working in collaboration with an arm of the UN, the UNFPA. They deal mainly with maternal health care. And we also work directly under the arm of Ministry of Health and Child Care, Family Health. So all those players, they get to tell us which our next camp is.
Fortune Mabande is the National Outreach Coordinator with Women in Health Alliance International. She spoke with Marvelous Nyawi of VOA Zimbabwe Service from Harare.
Next on Reporters Roundtable. Join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable. I'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the state of press freedom in Africa in the year 2015. So please join us on Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Pope Francis recently took his message of religious tolerance to Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC when host Shaka Sali and his guests discuss interfaith solutions to combat religious intolerance and extremism. That's next time on VOA Africa. We'll be right back.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sport with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Good evening, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. World Cup Nightline Africa Sports. Excitement is gradually building up in Abuja, Nigeria's capital city, as it prepares to host the 2015 Glow CAF Awards on January 7th, 2016. This is the second time the Nigerian capital is hosting the prestigious gala, having hosted the inaugural edition of Glow CAF Awards in 2005. The 2014 Glow CAF Awards Gala was held in Nigeria's commercial capital of Lagos. Our friend in Lagos, Segun Underdot Adeyemi, was at that event then and filed this report.
The highlight of the gala night was the announcement of Ivorian midfielder Yaya Toure as the 2014 African Player of the Year. The 31-year-old Toure thus becomes the first player to win the award four consecutive times. While former Cameroonian star Samuel Eto'o also won the award four times, only three were won in successive years. Here is how Toure's victory was announced, as well as his reaction to the historic achievement.
All right, let's stand up for the winner, ladies and gentlemen, winning it for a fourth year running. Yaya Toure, everybody.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, I want to thank Allah for all this achievement, you know. I've been very blessed all this year, you know. As well, I want to thank the football fans. And as well, I want to thank the CAF with the president and as well, all the guys, his committee as well. And the last, thank you to Africa. Thank you very much.
That was Ivorian midfielder Yaya Toure speaking after winning the 2014 African Player of the Year, the most prestigious individual award in African football. Coaches of national associations affiliated to African soccer's governing body, CAF, voted overwhelmingly to make Toure the winner. Toure got a total of 175 votes to beat Gabonese forward Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, who got 120 votes, and Nigeria's star goalkeeper Vincent Nyama, who secured 105 votes. Toure was not the only winner of the Night of Glitz and Glamour, but we'll get to that later. The annual Glow CAF Awards ceremony is always a combination of football and music, and the 2014 edition was not different. The announcement of the winners of the various categories was done in between musical interludes that featured the best in African music industry. One of them, Nigerian star Flavor, got the show onto a good start with some incredible female dancers entertaining the crowd that included the creme de la creme of African football, headed by CAF President Issa Hayatou. There was also the legendary South African trumpeter Hugh Masekela, who got a standing ovation. And then there was an energetic tribute to African football anthems by the Soweto Gospel Choir from South Africa and the masked Afro-Calypso artist from Nigeria, Lagbaja. Representative of the sponsors, Mrs. Gladys Talabi, also addressed the gathering.
The Glow CAF Awards has over the years been firmly established as the authentic platform to annually celebrate success stories in the African football. We are delighted by the keen competition in both male and female football on the continent. The quality of football on the continent is growing in leaps and bounds. we note with pride and a sense of fulfillment that one of the major contributory factors to the rising profile of football on the continent is the Glocalf Awards. We are proud to contribute to the resurgence of a game from which our people derive their biggest passion. On our part in Globacom, we wish to reiterate our commitment to do more for African football.
That was Mrs. Gladys Talabi, Executive Director, Legal Services at Globacom, the Nigerian telecommunications company sponsoring the annual Glocalf Awards. Now, let's quickly give a rundown of the winners in the other categories of the 2014 Glocalf Awards. African Player of the Year, based in Africa, Fami Mubele Ndombe of the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DR Congo. Women's Player of the Year, Asisa Toshoala of Nigeria, a double winner on the night as she also won the Youth Player of the Year award. Most Promising Talent, Yassin Brahimi of Algeria. Coach of the Year, Karadine Madoui of Algeria. National Team of the Year, Algeria. Women's National Team of the Year, Nigeria. Club of the Year, Antoine Setif of Algeria. Referee of the Year, Papa Bakri Gassama of the Gambia. Football Leader of the Year, Moise Katumbi Chapwe, President of TP Mazembe of DR Congo. African Legend Award, Orange Club of Cameroon, winner of the maiden edition of the CAF Champions League in 1964. This award created some emotions as the three surviving members of the club struggled to climb the stage to pick up the prize. Platinum Award, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, first president of Ghana, and Nigeria's president Goodluck Jonathan. And then CAF's finest 11, goalkeeper Vincent Nyama of Nigeria. Defenders, John Kasulula, DR Congo, Mehdi Benatia, Morocco, Stéphane Mbia, Cameroon, and Kwadwo Asamoah, Ghana. Midfielders, Yaya Toure, Ivory Coast, Yassine Brahimi, Algeria, Fakhreddin Ben Youssouf, Tunisia, and Ahmed Musa, Nigeria. And forwards, Asamoah Gyan of Ghana, and Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, Gabon. Just like the gala night started, it rounded off with music. Again, Flavor, who was later joined by the other performers of the night, sang out the ceremony with the Globacom anthem. This is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thanks, Segun. Meanwhile, the sponsors, telephone company Globacom, says the Glocalf Awards 2015 will parade the greatest African football legends, including the new African Football of the Year and winners in 12 other categories. And that's it for this edition of Netland Africa Sports. See you next year. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports Nightline, Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy. Nobody can love you like I do. Nobody can.
to touch you like I do.
So we go.
Neka carry bro me way. Supa, already wearing the crown and none can pull me down. It's where my time walk by. Ejo nyeka hiu kona kwa. Chukwa waya na nyibe jire. Sina nyahuku ke manja. Ojamele, 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 obodi deluto. Wakore bukini, ojamele, ojamele. No matter the galop, it's our destiny, and that's what we're gonna do. No matter the galop, it's our destiny, and that's what we're gonna do.
And that was our Sunday music spot. I hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English Service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
During this festive season, as we approach the end of the year and look forward to the new year in 2016, it may be appropriate to survey the continent to see whether there are developments which have been satisfying or hopeful. First of all is the combat by the international community of the dreaded virus Ebola. Throughout the year, people of the affected countries, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, suffered immensely from that virus. In their thousands, many died and others suffered miserably. But because of the cooperation of the countries concerned and the international community, we could now say that we can see the light at the end of the tunnel. Sierra Leone is enjoying its new status as Ebola-free. Liberia, which had gone in and out of that status, may soon be also Ebola-free, and hopefully Guinea will follow. But we should not forget the lessons that have been learned. Foremost, of course, is the need to strengthen the health institutions throughout the continent. Secondly, the practices which were adopted in the fight against Ebola should be maintained in some form for an extended period. In North Africa, we can say that Tunisia, the first victim of the so-called Arab Spring, has taken steps to heal itself. And in this connection, it is satisfying that local NGOs were offered the Nobel Peace Prize for their efforts to bring about reconciliation in the country. In Libya, baby steps have been taken to reconcile the rival governments. But we should never forget that Libya represents the folly of the policy of regime change. What we have learned is that this policy of regime change may have temporary satisfaction, but no long-term solution. We have seen that ISIL is trying now to set up station in Sirte, the birthplace of Gaddafi. But what we do know, and is uncontroversial, is that the removal of Colonel Gaddafi in 2011 has brought nothing but misery to the Libyan people and to tremendous problem to neighboring countries like Mali. As we look towards the east in Somalia, some progress are also being made. But Al-Shabaab is not dead. It is possible that Al-Shabaab may try again to conduct terrorist acts. But the steps which have been made should be maintained. But we should make efforts to strengthen democracy in Somalia. And 2016 should be used to broaden democracy by adding election and not to replicate the past practice of indirect election through clan leaders. Nigeria has had a successful change of government this year. The new leader, General Buhari, has already taken steps to fight corruption and to strengthen the economy of Nigeria. These are steps which may help to strengthen the economy of Nigeria in the new year. Of course, General Buhari said last week that for technical reasons that Boko Haram has been defeated. Now, the critics have said that this is a stretch, that Boko Haram can still cause enormous harm by terrorist acts by suicide bombers, and General Buhari acknowledged that. But critics must also bear in mind what one American senator said during the Vietnam War. When America was in a very difficult situation of the Tet Offensive, he proposed and was well received in the United States that the Johnson administration should declare victory and withdraw. And I think the idea of a technical defeat of Boko Haram may be in that direction in Nigeria. The one area where there is still some problem is in the Great Lake area. We have now just gone through a process in Rwanda where it is more than likely that the president of Rwanda may continue in office beyond the two terms. But we have seen the damage that this could do in Burundi. President Nkurunziza's attempt to change the constitution has now brought Burundi into a very terrible situation. And we should commend the efforts that have been made by the African Union to try to deploy forces in Burundi to assist the government and people to bring about reconciliation. But one thing Africans must bear in mind, and I know that Africans are divided on this issue, two-term is an attempt to strengthen democracy in Africa. It is not an attempt to ape other countries. And also one wonders why Africans have not been resourceful in dealing with this problem. If you look at the case of Russia, when President Putin completed his first two term, he did not change the constitution of Russia. Rather, he was imaginative and he decided not to run for the president, but the Prime Minister Medvedev was asked to run. He won the presidency and Putin became the Prime Minister. After one term, President Putin ran and again is now president without changing his constitution. Singapore also presented another case where the great leader, Lee Kuan Yew, after a lengthy period as Prime Minister, decided to withdraw and allow others to take on the command. But they worked out a situation whereby he stayed in the cabinet as a senior minister and help guide the new ministers. I think Africans should begin to be more imaginative and not go on with this silly idea that one man must always rule the country in Africa. As we look also in Kenya, we see some progress that are being made. And hopefully the end of the ICC saga may help to focus the attention of the government in Kenya to what is required to strengthen the economy. In South Africa, regrettably, we have a debacle where the President Zuma made changes as finance minister, and we could see that unless governments are very careful how they manage the economy, it could bring about some kind of collapse. But I think he has reversed himself by listening to the people, and hopefully South Africa will be on the match. So as we move to 2016, hopefully Africa will learn lessons from 2015 and march to a new era in the continent. I want to wish all listeners a prosperous and happy new year. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor William Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Nashwan Khaled, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, do not speak ill of the crocodile while your leg is still in the water. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
For countries trying to improve their economies and pull their people out of poverty, there is no better investment than educating their youth, particularly girls. According to the World Bank, educating girls is one of the most powerful instruments for reducing poverty and inequality and laying a foundation for sustained economic growth. Girls' attendance in secondary school is correlated with later marriage, later childbearing, lower maternal and infant mortality rates, lower birth rates, and lower rates of HIV/AIDS. When a girl receives a quality education, she is more likely to earn a decent living, raise a healthy, educated family, and improve the quality of life for herself, her family, and her community. Globally, there are nearly as many girls as boys in school at the primary level. Yet, in many areas of the world, there remains a gap in girls' attendance and completion at the secondary level. To help adolescent girls globally attend and complete school, President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama recently launched the Let Girls Learn initiative. Right now, 62 million girls who should be in school are not, and that's not an accident. It's the direct result of barriers, large and small, that stand in the way of girls who want to learn, said President Obama. The United States has long advocated for education opportunity for girls and women everywhere. Building on our previous investments, the Let Girls Learn initiative will expand on existing programs to bring in governments as well as private and public partners and challenge them to commit resources to help adolescent girls complete their educations and achieve their broader aspirations. We're making it clear to any country that's our partner or wants to be our partner that they need to get serious about increasing the number of girls in school, said President Obama. I want to make sure that no girl out there is denied her chance to be a strong, capable woman with the resources that she needs to succeed, that no girl is prevented from making her unique contributions to the world. Every child is precious. Every girl is precious. Every girl deserves an education.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.